Side 7. Late in the afternoon, I stepped from the trees onto what appeared to be a disused logging road. In the center of the road stood an older guy with a pack and a distinctly bewildered look, as if he had just woken from a trance and found himself unaccountably in this place. He had, I noticed, a haze of black flies of his own.
Which way does the trail go, do you suppose? He asked me.
It was an odd question, because the trail clearly and obviously continued on the other side. There was a 3-foot gap in the trees directly opposite, and, in case there was any possible doubt, a white blaze painted on a stout oak. I swatted the air before my face for the 12,000th time that day, and nodded at the opening. Just there, I'd say.
Oh, yes, he answered. Of course.
We set off into the woods together and chatted a little about where we had come from that day, where we were headed, and so on. He was a through hiker, the first I had seen this far north, and like me, was making for Dalton. He had a curious, puzzled look all the time, and regarded the trees in a peculiar way, running his gaze slowly up and down their lengths over and over again, as if he had never seen anything like them before. So, what's your name? I asked him.
Well, they call me Chicken John.
Chicken John? Chicken John was famous. I was quite excited. Some people on the trail take on an almost mythic status because of their idiosyncrasies. Early in the trip, Katz and I kept hearing about a kid who had equipment so high-tech that no one had ever seen anything like it. One of his possessions was a self-erecting tent. Apparently, he would carefully open a stuff sack, and it would fly out, like joke snakes from a tin. He also had a satellite navigation system, and goodness knows what else. The trouble was, his pack weighed about 95 pounds, and he dropped out before he got to Virginia, so we never did see him. Woodrow Murphy, the walking fat man, had achieved this sort of fame the year before. Mary Ellen would doubtless have attracted a measure of it if she had not dropped out. Chicken John had it now, though I couldn't for the life of me recall why. It had been months before, way back in Georgia, that I had first heard of him. So, why do they call you Chicken John? I asked.
You know, I don't honestly know, he said, as if for some time he had been wondering that himself.
When did you start your hike?
January the 27th.
January the 27th, I said in small astonishment, and did a quick private calculation on my fingers. That's almost 5 months.
Don't I know it,
he said with a kind of happy ruefulness. He had been walking for the better part of half a year, and he was still only 3/4 of the way to Katahdin. What kind of, I didn't know quite how to put this, what kind of miles are you doing, John?
Oh, about 14 or 15, if all goes well. Trouble is, he slid me a sheepish look, I get lost a lot.
That was it. Chicken John was forever losing the trail and ending up in the most improbable places. Goodness knows how anyone could manage to lose the Appalachian Trail. It is the most clearly defined, well-blazed footpath imaginable. Usually it is the only thing in the woods that isn't woods. If you can distinguish between trees and a long open corridor through the trees, you will have no trouble finding your way along the AT. Where there might be any doubt at all, where a side trail enters or where the AT crosses a road, there are always blazes. Yet people do get lost. The famous Grandma Gatewood, for instance, was forever knocking on doors and asking where the heck she was. I asked him what was the most lost he had ever been.
37 miles, he said,
almost proudly, or if not proudly, then fondly.
I got off the trail on Blood Mountain in Georgia. Still don't know how, exactly. And spent 3 days in the woods before I came to a highway. I thought I was a goner that time. I ended up in Tallulah Falls, and even got my picture in the paper. Police gave me a ride back to the trail the next day, and pointed me the right way. They were real nice.
Is it true you once walked 3 days in the wrong direction? He nodded happily.
2.5 days, to be precise. Luckily, I came to a town on the 3rd day, and I said to a fella, "Excuse me, young fellow, where is this?" And he said, "Why, it's Damascus, Virginia, sir." And I thought, well, that's mighty strange because I was in a place with the very same name just 3 days ago. And then I recognized the fire station.
How on earth do you...
I decided to rephrase the question. How does it happen, John, exactly?
Well, if I knew that, I wouldn't do it, I suppose, he said with a kind of chuckle. All I know is that from time to time I end up a long way from where I want to be. But it makes life interesting, you know. I've met a lot of nice people, had a lot of free meals. Excuse me, he said abruptly. Are you sure we're going the right way?
Positive.
He nodded. I'd hate to get lost today. There's a restaurant in Dalton.
I understood this perfectly.
If you're going to get lost, you don't want to do it on a restaurant day.
We walked the last 6 miles together, but we didn't talk much after that. I was doing a 19-mile day, the longest I would do anywhere on the trail, and even though the grade was generally easy and I was carrying a light pack, I was real tired by late afternoon. John seemed content to have someone to follow, and in any case, had his hands full scrutinizing the trees. It was after 6 when we reached Dalton. John had the name of a man on Depot Street who let hikers camp in his back garden and use his shower, so I went with him to a gas station while he asked directions. When we emerged, he started off in precisely the wrong direction.
"It's that way, John," I said.
"Oh, of course it is," he agreed. "And the name's Bernard, by the way. I don't know where they got that Chicken John from."
I nodded and told him I would look for him the next day, but I never did see him again. I spent the night in a motel, and the next day hiked on to Cheshire. It was only 9 miles over easy terrain, but the blackfly made it a torment. I've never seen a scientific name for these tiny, vile winged specks, so I don't know what they are other than a hovering mass that goes with you wherever you go and are forever in your ears and mouth and nostrils. Human sweat transports them to a realm of orgasmic ecstasy, and insect repellent only seems to excite them further. They are particularly relentless when you stop to rest or take a drink, so relentless that eventually you don't stop to rest, and you drink while moving, and then spit out a tongueful of them. It's a kind of living hell. So it was with some relief that I stepped from their woodland domain in early afternoon and strolled into the sunny, dozing straggle that was a little community of Cheshire. Cheshire had a free hostel for hikers in a church on the main street. Massachusetts people do a lot for hikers, it seems. Elsewhere, I had seen houses with signs inviting people to help themselves to water or pick apples from trees, but I didn't fancy a night in a bunkhouse, still less a long afternoon sitting around with nothing to do, so I pushed on to Adams, 4 miles away up a baking highway, but with at least the prospect of a night in a motel and a choice of restaurants. Adams had just one motel, a dumpy place on the edge of town. I took a room and passed the rest of the afternoon strolling around, idly looking in store windows and browsing through boxes of books in a thrift shop, though, of course, there was nothing but Reader's Digest volumes and those strange books you only ever see in thrift shops, with titles like Home Drainage Encyclopedia, Volume 1, and Nod If You Can Hear Me, Living with a Human Vegetable. And afterwards, wandered out into the country to look at Mount Greylock, my destination for the next day. Greylock is the highest eminence in Massachusetts, and the first hill over 3,000 feet since Virginia for northbound hikers. It's just 3,491 feet to the top, but surrounded as it is by much smaller hills, it looks considerably bigger. It has, in any case, a certain imposing majesty that beckons. I was looking forward to it. And so, early the next morning, before the day's heat had a chance to get properly underway and a scorcher was forecast, I stopped in town for a can of pop and a sandwich for my lunch and set off on a wandering dirt road towards the Gould Trail, a side trail leading steeply up to the AT and on to Greylock. Greylock is certainly the most literary of Appalachian mountains. Herman Melville, living on a farm called Arrowhead on its western side, stared at it from his study window while he wrote Moby Dick. And according to Maggie Steer and Ron McAdoo in their excellent Into the Mountains, A History of New England's Peaks, claimed that its profile reminded him of a whale. When the book was finished, he and a group of friends hiked to the top and partied there till dawn. Nathaniel Hawthorne and Edith Wharton also lived nearby and set works there. And there was scarcely a literary figure associated with New England from the 1850s to 1920s who didn't at some time hike or ride up to admire the view. Ironically, at the height of its fame, Greylock lacked much of the green-cloaked majesty it enjoys today. Its sides were mangy with the scars of logging, and the lower slopes gouged with holes for slate and marble quarries. Big ramshackle sheds and saw houses poked into every view. All that healed and grew over. And then in the 1960s, with the enthusiastic support of state officials in Boston, plans were drawn up to turn Greylock into a ski resort, with an aerial tram, a network of chairlifts, and a summit complex consisting of a hotel, shops, and restaurants, all in 1960s Jetson-style architecture. But luckily, nothing ever came of it. Today, Greylock sits on 11,600 acres of preserved land. It's a beauty. The hike to the top was steep, hot, and seemingly endless, but worth the effort. The open, sunny, fresh-aired summit of Greylock is crowned with a large, handsome stone building called Bascom Lodge, built in the 1930s by the tireless and ubiquitous cadre of the Civilian Conservation Corps. It now offers overnight accommodation to hikers and a restaurant. Also on the summit is a wonderful, wildly incongruous lighthouse. Greylock is 140 miles from the sea, which serves as the Massachusetts Memorial for soldiers killed in the First World War. It was originally planned to stand in Boston Harbor, but for some reason ended up here. I ate my lunch, treated myself to a wee and a wash in the lodge, and then hurried on, for I still had 8 miles to go, and I had a rendezvous arranged with my wife at 4 in Williamstown. For the next 3 miles, the walk was mostly along a lofty ridgeline connecting Greylock to Mount Williams. The views were sensational, across lazy hills to the Adirondacks, half a dozen miles to the west, but really hot. Even up here, the air was heavy and listless. And then it was a very steep descent, 3,000 feet in 3 miles, through dense, cool woods to a back road that led through exquisitely pretty open countryside. Out of the woods, it was sweltering. It was 2 miles along a road totally without shade, and so hot I could feel the heat through the soles of my boots. When at last I reached Williamstown, a sign on a bank announced a temperature of 97 degrees. No wonder I was hot. I crossed the street and stepped into a Burger King, our agreed rendezvous. If there is a greater reason for being grateful to live in the 20th century than the joy of stepping from the dog's breath air of a really hot summer's day into the crisp, clean, surgical chill of an air-conditioned establishment, then I can't think of it. I bought a bucket-sized Coke and sat in a booth by the window feeling very pleased. I had done 17 miles over a reasonably challenging mountain in hot weather. I was grubby, sweat-streaked, comprehensively knackered, and rank enough to turn heads. I was a walker again. In 1850, New England was 70% open farmland and 30% woods. Today, the proportions are exactly reversed. Probably no area in the developed world has undergone a more profound change in just a century or so, at least not in a contrary direction to the normal course of progress. If you were going to be a farmer, you could hardly choose a worse place than New England. Well, the middle of Lake Erie, maybe, but you know what I mean. The soil is rocky, the terrain steep, and the weather so bad that people take actual pride in it. A year in Vermont, according to an old saw, is 9 months of winter followed by 3 months of very poor sledding. But until the middle of the 19th century, farmers survived in New England because they had proximity to the coastal cities like Boston and Portland, and because, I suppose, they didn't know any better. Then two things happened. The invention of the McCormick Reaper, which was ideally suited to the big rolling farms of the Middle West, but no good at all for the cramped, stony fields of New England, and the development of the railroads, which allowed the Midwestern farmers to get their produce to the East in a timely fashion. The New England farmers couldn't compete, and so they became Midwestern farmers, too. By 1860, nearly half of Vermont-born people, 200,000 out of 450,000, were living elsewhere. In 1840, during the presidential election campaign, Daniel Webster gave an address to 20,000 people on Stratton Mountain in Vermont. Had he tried the same thing 20 years later, which admittedly would have been a good trick as he had died in the meantime, he would have been lucky to get an audience of 50. Today, Stratton Mountain is pretty much all forest, though if you look carefully, you can still see old cellar holes and the straggly remnants of apple orchards clinging glumly to life in the shady understory beneath younger, more assertive birches, maples, and hickories. Everywhere throughout New England, you find old, tumble-down field walls, often in the middle of the deepest, most settled-looking woods, a reminder of just how swiftly nature reclaims the land in America. And so I walked up Stratton Mountain on an overcast, mercifully cool June day. It was 4 steep miles to the summit at just under 4,000 feet. For a little over 100 miles through Vermont, the AT coexists with a long trail, which threads its way up and over the biggest and most famous peaks of the Green Mountains all the way to Canada. The long trail is actually older than the AT. It was opened in 1921, the year the AT was proposed. And I'm told that there are long trail devotees even yet who look down on the AT as a rather vulgar and overambitious upstart. In any case, Stratton Mountain is usually cited as the spiritual birthplace of both trails, for it was here that James P. Taylor and Benton McKay claimed to have received the inspiration that led to the creation of their wilderness ways. Taylor in 1909, McKay sometime afterwards. Stratton was a perfectly fine mountain, with good views across to several other well-known peaks, Equinox, Ascutney, Snow, and Monadnock. But I couldn't say that it was a summit that would have inspired me to grab a hatchet and start clearing a route to Georgia or Quebec. Perhaps it was just the dull, heavy skies and bleak light which gave everything a flat, washed-out feel. 8 or 9 other people were scattered around the summit, but there was one youngish, rather podgy man on his own, in a very new and expensive-looking windcheater. He had some kind of handheld electronic device with which he was taking mysterious readings of the sky or landscape. He noticed me watching and said, in a tone that suggested he was hoping someone would take an interest, "It's an enviro-monitor." "Oh, yes," I responded politely. "Measures 80 values, temperature, UV index, dew point, you name it." He tilted the screen so I could see it. "That's heat stress." It was some meaningless number that ended in 2 decimal places. "It does solar radiation," he went on, "barometric pressure, wind chill, rainfall, humidity, ambient and active, even estimated burn time adjusted for skin type." "Does it bake cookies?" I asked. He didn't like this. "There are times when it could save your life, believe me," he said a little stoutly. I tried to imagine a situation in which I might find myself dangerously imperiled by a rising dew point, and could not. But I didn't want to upset the man, so I said, "What's that?" and pointed at a blinking figure in the upper left-hand corner of the screen. "I'm not sure what that is." "But this," he stabbed the console of buttons, "now this is solar radiation." It was another meaningless figure to 3 decimal places. "It's very low today," he said, and angled the machine to take another reading. "Yeah, very low today." Somehow I knew this already. In fact, although I couldn't attest any of it to 3 decimal places, I had a pretty good notion of the weather conditions generally, on account of I was out in them. The interesting thing about the man was that he had no pack, and so no waterproofs, and was wearing shorts and trainers, if the weather did swiftly deteriorate, and in New England it most assuredly can, he would probably die. But at least he had a machine that would tell him when and let him know his final dew point. Call me a tiresome old fogey, but I hate all this technology on the trail. Some AT hikers I had read now carry laptop computers and modems so they can file daily reports to their family and friends. If you are considering doing this yourself, here's a tip. Nobody cares that much. I'm sorry, that's not true. Nobody cares at all. And now, increasingly, you find people with electronic gizmos like the Enviro Monitor, or wearing sensors attached by wires to their pulse points, so that they look as if they've come to the trail straight from some sleep clinic. In 1996, the Wall Street Journal ran a splendid article on the nuisance of satellite navigation devices, cell phones, and other such appliances in the wilderness. All this high-tech equipment, it appears, is drawing up into the mountains people who perhaps shouldn't be there. At Baxter State Park in Maine, the journal reported, one hiker called up a National Guard unit and asked them to send a helicopter to airlift him off Mount Katahdin because he was tired. On Mount Washington, meanwhile, two very demanding women, according to an official there, called the Mountain Patrol HQ and said they couldn't manage the last mile and a half to the summit, even though there were still 4 hours of daylight left. They asked for a rescue team to come and carry them back to their car. The request was refused. A few minutes later, they called again and demanded in that case that a rescue team bring them some torches. That request was refused also. A few days later, another hiker called and requested a helicopter because he was a day behind schedule and was afraid he would miss an important business meeting. The article also described several people who had got lost with satellite navigation devices. They were able to report their positions as 36.2 degrees north by 17.48 degrees west or whatever, but unfortunately didn't have the faintest idea what that meant, as they hadn't brought maps or compasses or, evidently, brains. My new friend on Stratton, I believe, could have joined their club. I asked him whether he felt it was safe for me to make a descent with solar radiation showing 18.574. Oh, yeah, he said quite earnestly. Solar radiation-wise, today is very low risk. Thank goodness, I said, quite earnestly too, and took my leave of him and the mountain. And so I proceeded across Vermont in a series of pleasant day hikes, without anything electronic, but with some very nice packed lunches that my wife made for me each night before retiring and left in precisely the same spot on the top shelf in the fridge. Each morning I would rise at dawn, put my lunch in my pack, and drive off to Vermont. I would park the car and walk up a big mountain or across a series of rolling green hills. At some point in the day when it pleased me, usually about 11 a.m., I would sit on a rock or a log, take out my packed lunch, and examine the contents. I would go, as appropriate, peanut butter cookies, my favorite, or, luncheon meat again, and eat in a zestful, chewy silence, thinking of all the mountaintops I had sat on with cats, where we would have killed for this. Then I would pack up everything very neatly, drop it in my pack, and hike again till it was time to clock off and go home. And so passed late June and the first part of July. I did Stratton Mountain and Bromley Mountain, Prospect Rock and Spruce Peak, Baker Peak and Griffith Lake, White Rocks Mountain, Button Hill, Killington Peak, Gifford Woods State Park, Quimby Mountain, Thistle Hill, and finally concluded with a gentle 11-mile amble from West Hartford to Norwich. This took me past Happy Hill Cabin, the oldest shelter on the AT, and possibly the most sweetly picturesque. It was torn down soon after by some foolishly unsentimental trail officials. The town of Norwich is notable for three things. For being pronounced Norwich, it used to be Norwich before it got taken over by outsiders in the 1950s. For being the town that inspired the Bob Newhart show on television, the one where he ran an inn and all the locals were charmingly imbecilic, and for being the home of the great Alden Partridge, of whom no one has ever heard, though of course you are about to. Partridge was born in Norwich in 1755 and was a demon walker, possibly the first person on the whole planet who walked long distances for the pleasure of it. In 1785, he became superintendent of West Point at the unprecedentedly youthful age of 30, then had some kind of falling out there, moved back to Norwich, and set up a rival institution, the American Literary, Scientific, and Military Academy. There he coined the term physical education, and took his appalled young charges on brisk rambles of 35 or 40 miles over the neighboring mountains. In between times, he went off on more ambitious hikes of his own. On a typical trip, he strode 110 miles over the mountains from Norwich to Williamstown, Massachusetts, essentially the route I had just completed in gentle stages, trotted up Mount Greylock, and came back home the same way. The trip there and back took him just 4 days. And this at a time, remember, when there were no maintained footpaths or helpful blazes. He did this sort of thing with virtually every peak in New England. There ought to be a plaque to him somewhere in Norwich to inspire the few hardy hikers still heading north at this point, but sadly there is none. From Norwich, it is about a mile to the Connecticut River, and a pleasant, unassuming 1930s bridge, leading to the state of New Hampshire and the town of Hanover on the opposite bank. Once the road that led from Norwich to Hanover was a leafy, gently sinuous two-lane affair, the sort of tranquil, alluring byway you would hope to find connecting two old New England towns a mile apart. Then some highway official or other decided that what would be a really good idea would be to build a big, fast road between the two towns. That way people could drive the 1 mile from Norwich to Hanover perhaps as much as 8 seconds faster, and not have to suffer paroxysms of anguish if somebody ahead wanted to turn onto a side road, because now there would be turning lanes everywhere. Turning lanes big enough for a truck pulling a Titan missile to maneuver through without rolling over a curb or disrupting the vital flow of traffic. So they built a broad, straight highway, 6 lanes wide in places, with concrete dividers down the middle and outsized sodium street lamps that light the night sky for miles around. Unfortunately, this had the effect of making the bridge into a bottleneck, where the road narrowed back to 2 lanes. Sometimes 2 cars would arrive simultaneously at the bridge, and one of them would have to give way. Well, imagine! So, as I write, they are replacing that uselessly attractive old bridge with something much grander, and in keeping with the age of concrete. For good measure, they are widening the street that leads up a short hill to the center of Hanover. Of course, that means chopping down trees all along the street, and drastically foreshortening most of the front gardens with concrete retaining walls, and even a highway official would have to admit that the result is not exactly a picture, not something you would want to put on a calendar called Beautiful New England, but it will shave a further 4 seconds off that daunting trek from Norwich, and that's the main thing. All this is of some significance to me, partly because I live in Hanover, but mostly, I believe, because I live in the late 20th century. Luckily, I have a good imagination, so as I strode from Norwich to Hanover, I imagined not a lively mini-expressway, but a country lane, shaded with trees, bounded with hedges and wildflowers, and graced with a stately line of modestly scaled lampposts, from each of which was suspended upside down a highway official. And I felt much better. Chapter 17. Of all the catastrophic fates that can befall you in the out-of-doors, perhaps none is more eerily unpredictable than hypothermia. There is scarcely an instance of hypothermic death that isn't in some measure mysterious and improbable. Consider a small story related by David Quammen in his book Natural Acts. In the late summer of 1982, 4 youths and 2 men were on a canoeing holiday in Banff National Park when they failed to return to their base camp at the end of the day. The next morning, a search party went out looking for them. They found the missing canoeists floating dead in their life jackets in a lake. All were face up and composed. Nothing about them indicated distress or panic. One of the men was still wearing his hat and glasses. Their canoes drifting nearby were sound, and the weather overnight had been calm and mild. For some unknowable reason, the 6 had carefully left their canoes and lowered themselves fully dressed into the cold water of the lake, where they had peacefully perished. In the words of one witness, it was like they had just gone to sleep. In a sense, they had. Popular impressions to the contrary, relatively few victims of hypothermia die in extreme conditions, stumbling through blizzards or fighting the bite of Arctic winds. To begin with, relatively few people go out in that kind of weather, and those that do are generally prepared. Most victims of hypothermia die in a much more dopey kind of way, in temperate seasons and with the air temperature nowhere near freezing. Typically, they are caught by an unforeseen change of conditions, or combination of changes, a sudden drop in temperature, a cold, pelting rain, the realization that they are lost, for which they are emotionally or physically under-equipped. Nearly always, they compound the problem by doing something foolhardy, leaving a well-marked path in search of a shortcut, blundering deeper into the woods when they would have been better off staying put, fording streams that only get them wetter and colder. Such was the unfortunate fate of Richard Salinas. In 1990, Salinas went hiking with a friend in Pisgah National Forest in North Carolina. Caught by fading light, they headed back to their car, but somehow became separated. Salinas was an experienced hiker, and all he had to do was follow a well-defined trail down a mountain to a car park. He never made it. 3 days later, his jacket and knapsack were found abandoned on the ground miles into the woods. His body was discovered 2 months later, snagged on branches in the Little Linville River. As far as anyone can surmise, he had left the trail in search of a shortcut, got lost, plunged deep into the woods, panicked and plunged deeper still, until at last hypothermia fatally robbed him of his senses. Hypothermia is a gradual and insidious sort of trauma. It overtakes you literally by degrees, as your body temperature falls and your natural responses grow sluggish and disordered. In such a state, Salinas had abandoned his possessions and soon after made the desperate and irrational decision to try to cross the rain-swollen river, which in normal circumstances he would have realized could only take him further away from his goal. On the night he had got lost, the weather was dry and the temperature in the 40s. Had he kept his jacket and stayed out of the water, he would have had an uncomfortably chilly night and a story to tell. Instead, he died. A person suffering hypothermia experiences several progressive stages, beginning, as you would expect, with mild and then increasingly violent shivering, as the body tries to warm itself with muscular contractions, and proceeding on to profound weariness, heaviness of movement, a distorted sense of time and distance, and increasingly helpless confusion, resulting in a tendency to make imprudent or illogical decisions and a failure to observe the obvious. Gradually, the sufferer grows thoroughly disoriented and subject to increasingly dangerous hallucinations, including the decidedly cruel misconception that he is not freezing but burning up. Many victims tear off clothing, fling away their gloves, or crawl out of their sleeping bags. The annals of trail deaths are full of stories of hikers found half-naked lying in snowbanks just outside their tents. When this stage is reached, shivering ceases as the body just gives up and apathy takes over. The heart rate falls and brain waves begin to look like a drive across the prairies. By this time, even if the victim is found, the shock of revival may be more than his body can bear. This was neatly illustrated by an incident reported in the January 1997 issue of Outside magazine. In 1980, according to the article, 16 Danish seamen issued a mayday call, donned life jackets, and jumped into the North Sea as their vessel sank beneath them. There, they bobbed for 90 minutes before a rescue ship was able to lift them from the water. Even in summer, the North Sea is so perishingly cold that it can kill a person immersed in it in as little as 30 minutes. So the survival of all 16 was a cause of some jubilation. They were wrapped in blankets and guided below, where they were given a hot drink and abruptly dropped dead, all 16 of them. But enough of a resting anecdote. Let's toy with this fascinating malady ourselves. I was in New Hampshire now, which pleased me because we had recently moved to the state, so I was naturally interested to explore it. Vermont and New Hampshire are so snugly proximate and so similar in size, climate, accent, and livelihoods, principally skiing and tourism, that they are often bracketed as twins, but in fact they have quite different characters. Vermont is Volvos and antique shops and country inns with cutely contrived names like Quail Hollow Lodge and Fiddlehead Farm Inn. New Hampshire is guys in hunting caps and pickup trucks, with number plates bearing the feisty slogan, "Live Free or Die." The landscape, too, differs crucially. Vermont's mountains are comparatively soft and rolling, and its profusion of dairy farms gives it a more welcoming and inhabited feel. New Hampshire is one big forest. Of the state's 9,304 square miles of territory, some 85%, or an area somewhat larger than Wales, is woods, and nearly all the rest is either lakes or above treeline. So, apart from the very occasional town or ski resort, New Hampshire is primarily, sometimes rather dauntingly, wilderness, and its hills are loftier, craggier, more difficult, and forbidding. In the Through Hiker's Handbook, the one indispensable guide to the AT, I might just say here, the great Dan Wingfoot Bruce notes that when the northbound hiker leaves Vermont, he has completed 80% of the miles, but just 50% of the effort. The New Hampshire portion alone, running 162 miles through the White Mountains, has 35 peaks over 3,000 feet. If Ben Nevis were on the Appalachian Trail in New Hampshire, it would just squeak into the top 10. Snowden would be swallowed without trace. New Hampshire is hard. I had heard so much about the ardors and dangers of the White Mountains that I was mildly uneasy about venturing into them alone. Not terrified exactly, but prepared to be if I heard just one more bear chase story. So you may conceive my quiet joy when a friend and neighbor named Bill Abdu offered to accompany me on some day hikes. Bill is a very nice fellow, amiable and full of knowledge, experienced on mountain trails, and with the inestimable bonus that he is a gifted orthopedic surgeon. Just what you want in a dangerous wilderness. I didn't suppose he'd be able to do much useful surgery up there, but if I fell and broke my back, at least I'd know the Latin names for what was wrong with me. We decided to start with Mount Lafayette, and to that end set off by car one clear July dawn, and drove the 2 hours to Franconia Notch State Park, a notch in New Hampshire parlance as a mountain pass, a famous beauty spot at repose beneath commanding summits in the heart of the 700,000-acre White Mountain National Forest. Lafayette is 5,249 feet of steep, heartless granite. An 1870s account, quoted in Into the Mountains, observes, "Mount Lafayette is a true Alp, with peaks and crags on which lightnings play, its sides brown with scars and deep with gorges." All true. It's a beast. Only nearby Mount Washington exceeds it for both heft and popularity as a hiking destination in the White Mountains. From the valley floor, we had 3,700 feet of climb, 2,000 feet of it in the first 2 miles, and three smaller peaks en route, Mount Liberty, Little Haystack, and Mount Lincoln. But it was a splendid morning, with mild but abundant sunshine and that invigorating, minty-clean air you only get in northern mountains. It had the makings of a flawless day. We walked for perhaps 3 hours, talking little because of the steepness of the climb, but enjoying being out and keeping a good pace. Every guidebook, every experienced hiker, every signboard beside every trailhead car park warns you that the weather in the White Mountains can change in an instant. Stories of campers who go for a stroll along sunny heights in shorts and sneakers, only to find themselves, 3 or 4 hours later, stumbling to unhappy deaths in freezing fog, are the stuff of every campfire. But they are also true. It happened to us when we were a few hundred feet shy of the summit of Little Haystack Mountain. The sunshine abruptly vanished, and from out of nowhere, a swirling mist rolled into the trees. With it came a sudden fall in temperature, as if we had stepped into a cold store. Within minutes, the forest was settled in a great foggy stillness, chill and damp. Timberline in the White Mountains occurs as low as 4,800 feet, about half the height in most other ranges, because the weather is so much more severe, and I began to see why. As we emerged from a zone of krumholz, the stunted trees that mark the last gasp of forest at treeline, and stepped onto the barren roof of Little Haystack, we were met by a stiff, sudden wind, the kind that would snatch a hat from your head and fling it 100 yards before you could raise a hand, which the mountain had deflected over us on the sheltered western slopes, but which here, was flying unopposed across the open summit. We stopped in the lee of some boulders to put on waterproofs, for the extra warmth as much as anything, for I was already quite damp from the sweat of effort and the moist air, a clearly foolish state to be in with the temperature falling and the wind whisking away any body heat. I opened my pack, rooted through the contents, and then looked up with that confounded expression that comes with the discovery of a reversal. I didn't have my waterproofs. I rooted again, but there was hardly anything in the pack, a map, a light jumper, a water bottle, and a packed lunch. I thought for a moment, and with a small inward sigh, remembered pulling the waterproofs out some days before, and spreading them out in the basement to air. I hadn't remembered to put them back. Bill, tightening a drawstring on his windcheater hood, looked over. "Something wrong?" I told him. He made a grave expression. "Do you want to turn back?" "Oh, no." I genuinely didn't want to. Besides, it wasn't that bad. There wasn't any rain, and I was only a little chilly. I put the jumper on and felt immediately better. Together, we looked at his map. We had done almost all the height, and it was only a mile and a half along a ridgeline to Lafayette, at which point we would descend steeply, 1,200 feet, to Greenleaf Hut, a mountain lodge with a cafeteria. If I did need to warm up, we would reach the hut a lot faster than if we went 5 miles back down the mountain to the car.
"You sure you don't want to turn back?"
"No," I insisted. "We'll be there in half an hour." So we set off again into the galloping wind and depthless gray murk. We cleared Mount Lincoln at 5,100 feet, then descended slightly to a very narrow ridgeline. Visibility was no more than 15 feet, and the winds were razor sharp. Air temperature falls by about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit with every 1,000 feet of elevation, so it would have been chillier at this height anyway, but now it was positively uncomfortable. I watched with alarm as my jumper accumulated hundreds of tiny beads of moisture, which gradually began to penetrate the fabric and join the dampness of the shirt beneath. Before we had gone a quarter of a mile, the jumper was wet through and hanging heavily on my arms and shoulders. To make things worse, I was wearing blue jeans. Everyone will tell you that blue jeans are the most foolish item of clothing you can wear on a hike. I had contrarily become something of a devotee because they are tough and give good protection against thorns, ticks, insects, and poison ivy, perfect for the woods. However, I freely concede they are completely useless in cold and wet. The cotton jumper was something I had packed as a formality, as you might pack anti-snake bite medicine or splints. It was July, for goodness sake. I hadn't expected to need any kind of outerwear beyond possibly my trusty waterproofs, which, of course, I didn't have either. In short, I was dangerously misattired and all but asking to suffer and die. I certainly suffered. I was lucky to escape with that. The wind was whooshing along noisily and steadily at a brisk 25 miles an hour, but gusting to at least double that, and from ever-shifting directions. At times, when the wind was head-on, we would take 2 steps forward and 1 back. When it came from an angle, it gave us a stiff shove towards the edge of the ridge. There was no telling in the fog how far the fall would be on either side, but it looked awfully steep, and we were, after all, a mile up in the clouds. If conditions had deteriorated just a little, if the fog had completely obscured our footing or the gusts had gathered just enough bump to knock a grown man over, we would have been pinned down up there, with me pretty well soaked through. 40 minutes before, we had been whistling in sunshine. I understood now how people die in the White Mountains, even in summer. As it was, I was in a state of mild distress. I was shivering foolishly and feeling oddly lightheaded. There didn't seem to be any call to panic just yet, but I was clearly in bother. The ridge seemed to run on forever, and there was no guessing in the milky void how long it would be till the form of Lafayette would rise to meet us. I glanced at my watch. It was 11:02, just right for lunch, when and if we ever got to the godforsaken lodge, and took some comfort from the thought that at least I still had my wits about me. Or at least I felt as if I did. Presumably, a confused person would be too addled to recognize that he was confused. Ergo, if you know that you are not confused, then you are not confused. Unless, it suddenly occurred to me, and here was an arresting notion, unless persuading yourself that you are not confused is merely a cruel early symptom of confusion. Or even an advanced symptom. Who could tell? For all I knew, I could be stumbling into some kind of helpless pre-confusional state, characterized by the fear on the part of the sufferer that he may be stumbling into some kind of helpless pre-confusional state. That's the trouble with losing your mind. By the time it's gone, it's too late to get it back. I glanced at my watch again and discovered with horror that it was still only 2:58. My sense of time was going. I might not be able to reliably assess my faltering brain, but here was proof on my wrist. How long would it be till I was dancing around half-naked and trying to beat out flames, or seized with a brilliant notion that the best way out of this mess would be to glide to the valley floor on a magic invisible parachute? I whimpered a little and scooted on, waited a good full minute and stole a glance at my watch again. Still 2:58. I was definitely in trouble. Bill, who seemed serenely impervious to cold, and, of course, had no idea that we were doing anything but proceeding along a high ridge in an unseasonal breeze, looked back from time to time to ask how I was doing. "Great," I'd say, for I was too embarrassed to admit that I was in fact losing my mind preparatory to stepping over the edge with a private smile and a cry of, "See you on the other side, old friend." I don't suppose he had ever lost a patient on a mountaintop, and I didn't wish to alarm him. Besides, I wasn't entirely convinced I was losing my grip, just severely uncomfortable. I've no idea how long it took us to reach the windy summit of Lafayette, other than that it was a double eternity. 100 years ago, there was a hotel on this bleak, forbidding spot, and its wind-worn foundations are still a landmark. I have seen it in photographs, but I have no recollection of it now. My focus was entirely on descending the side trail to Greenleaf Hut. It led through a vast talus field and then a mile or so further on into woods. Almost as soon as we left the summit, the wind dropped, and within 500 feet the world was quite calm, eerily so, and the dense fog was nothing more than straggly drifting shreds. Suddenly we could see the world below, and how high up we were, which was a considerable distance, though all the nearby summits were wreathed in clouds. To my surprise and gratification, I felt much better. I stood up straight, with a sense of novelty, and realized that I had been walking in a severe hunch for some time. Yes, I definitely felt much better. Hardly cold at all, and agreeably clear-headed. "Well, that wasn't so bad," I said to Bill with a mountain man chuckle, and pressed on to the hut. Greenleaf Hut is one of 10 picturesque and, in this case, brilliantly handy stone lodges built and maintained in the White Mountains by the venerable Appalachian Mountain Club. The AMC, founded over 120 years ago, is not only the oldest hiking club in America, but the oldest conservation group of any type. It charges a decidedly ambitious $50 a night for a bunk, dinner, and breakfast, and consequently is known to thru-hikers as the Appalachian Money Club. Plus, you have to make reservations days or sometimes weeks in advance. It doesn't really give the impression of being the thru-hiker's friend, more a hiking club for Cape Cod types. Still, to its credit, the AMC maintains 1,400 miles of trails in the Whites, runs an excellent visitor center at Pinkham Notch, publishes worthwhile books, and does let you come into its huts to use the toilets, get water, or just warm up, which is what we gratefully did now. We purchased cups of warming coffee and took them to a set of refectory tables where we sat with a sprinkling of other steamy hikers and ate our packed lunches. The lodge was very congenial in a basic and rustic sort of way, with a high ceiling and plenty of room to move around. When we'd finished, I was beginning to stiffen up, so I got up to move around and looked in on one of the two dormitories. It was a large room, packed with built-in bunks stacked 4 high. It was clean and airy, but startlingly basic, and presumably would be like an army barracks at night when it was full of hikers and their equipment. It didn't look remotely appealing to me. Benton Mackay had nothing to do with these huts, but they were absolutely in accord with his vision. Spare, rustic, wholesomely communal. And I realized with a kind of dull shock that if his dreams of a string of trailside hostels had been realized, this is precisely how they would have been. My fantasy of a relaxed and cozy refuge with a porch full of rockers would actually have been rather more like a spell at boot camp, and an expensive one at that, if the AMC's fees were anything to go by. I did a quick calculation. Assuming $50 as the standard price, it would have cost the average thru-hiker somewhere between $6,000 and $7,500 to stay in a lodge each night along the trail. Clearly, it would never have worked. Perhaps it was better that things were as they were. The sun was shining weakly when we emerged from the hut and set off back down the mountain on a side trail to Franconia Notch, and as we descended it gathered strength, until we were back in a nice July day, with the air lazy and mild, and the trees fetchingly speckled with sunlight and birdsong. By the time we reached the car, in late afternoon, I was almost completely dry, and my passing fright on Lafayette, now basking in hearty sunshine against the backdrop of vivid blue sky, seemed a remote memory. As we climbed in, I glanced at my watch. It said 11:02. I gave it a shake, and watched with interest as the second hand kicked back into motion. Chapter 18. On the afternoon of 12 April 1934, Salvatore Pagliuccia, a meteorologist at the Summit Weather Observatory on Mount Washington, had an experience no one else has had before or since. Mount Washington sometimes gets a little gusty, to put it mildly, and this was a particularly breezy day. In the previous 24 hours, the wind speed had not fallen below 107 miles an hour, and often gusted much higher. When it came time for Pagliuccia to take the afternoon readings, the wind was so strong that he tied a rope round his waist and had two colleagues take hold of the other end. As it was, the men had difficulty just getting the weather station door open and needed all their strength to keep Pagliuccia from becoming a kind of human kite. How Pagliuccia managed to reach his weather instruments and take readings is not known, nor are his words when he finally tumbled back in, though Jesus would seem an apt possibility. What is certain is that Pagliuccia had just experienced a surface wind speed of 231 miles an hour. Nothing approaching that velocity has ever been recorded elsewhere. In The Worst Weather on Earth, A History of the Mount Washington Observatory, William Lowell Putnam dryly notes, "There may be worse weather from time to time at some forbidding place on planet Earth, but it has yet to be reliably recorded." Among the Mount Washington weather station's many other records are most weather instruments destroyed, most wind in 24 hours, nearly 3,100 miles of it, and lowest wind chill, a combination of 100-mile-per-hour winds and a temperature of minus 47 degrees Fahrenheit, a severity unmatched even in Antarctica. Washington owes its curiously extreme weather not so much to height or latitude, though both are factors, as to its position at the precise point where high-altitude weather systems from Canada and the Great Lakes pile into moist, comparatively warm air from the Atlantic or southern U.S. In consequence, it receives 246 inches of snow a year and snowpacks of 20 feet. In one memorable storm in 1969, 98 inches of snow, that's 8 feet, fell on the summit in 3 days. Wind is a particular feature. On average, it blows at hurricane force over 75 miles per hour on 2 winter days in 3, and on 40% of days overall. Because of the length and bitterness of its winters, the average mean annual temperature at the summit is a meager 27 degrees Fahrenheit. The summer average is 52 degrees Fahrenheit, a good 25 degrees Fahrenheit lower than at its base. It is a brutal mountain. And yet people go up there, or at least try to, even in winter. In Into the Mountains, Maggie Steer and Ron McAdoo record how two University of New Hampshire students, Derek Tinkham and Jeremy Haas, decided to hike the entire presidential range, 7 summits, including Washington, all named for U.S. presidents, in January 1994. Although they were experienced winter hikers and were well-equipped, they couldn't have imagined what they were letting themselves in for. On their second night, the winds rose to 90 miles an hour and the temperature plummeted to minus 32 degrees Fahrenheit. I have experienced minus 25 degrees Fahrenheit in calm conditions and can tell you that even well-wrapped and with the benefit of residual heat from indoors, it becomes distinctly uncomfortable within a couple of minutes. Somehow, the two survived the night, but the next day, Haas announced he could go no further. Tinkham helped him into a sleeping bag, then stumbled onto the weather observatory a little over 2 miles away. He made it, just, though he was gravely frostbitten. His friend was found the next day, half out of his sleeping bag and frozen solid. Scores of others have perished in far less taxing conditions on Washington. One of the earliest and most famous deaths was that of a young woman named Lizzie Bourne, who in 1855, not long after Mount Washington began to attract tourists, decided to amble up in the company of 2 male companions on a summery September afternoon. As you will have guessed already, the weather turned, and they found themselves lost in fog. Somehow they got separated. The men made it after nightfall to a hotel on the summit. Lizzie was found the next day, just 150 feet from the front door, but quite dead. Altogether, 122 people have lost their lives on Washington. Until recently, when it was overtaken by Mount Denali in Alaska, it was the most murderous mountain in North America. So, when the fearless Dr. Abdu and I pulled up at its base a few days later for the second of our grand descents, I had brought enough backup clothes to cross the Arctic. Waterproofs, woolen jumper, jacket, gloves, spare trousers, and long underwear. Never again would I be chilled at height. Washington, the highest peak north of the Smokies and east of the Rockies, at a solidly respectable 6,288 feet, gets few clear days. And this was a clear day, so the crowds were out in force. I counted over 70 cars at the Pinkham Notch Visitor Center car park at 8:10 in the morning when we arrived, and more pouring in every minute. Mount Washington is the most popular summit in the White Mountains, and the Tuckerman Ravine Trail, our chosen route, is the most popular trail up Mount Washington. Some 60,000 hikers a year take to the Tuckerman route, though a good many of them get a lift to the top of the mountain and walk down, so the figures are perhaps a trifle skewed. In any case, it was no more than moderately busy on a good, hot, blue-skied, gorgeously promising morning in late July. The walk-up was much easier than I had dared hope. Even now, I could not quite get used to the novelty of walking big hills without a large pack. It makes such a difference. I won't say we bounded up, but considering that we had almost 4,500 feet of climb in a little over 3 miles, we walked at a pretty steady clip. It took us 2 hours and 40 minutes. Bill's hiking guide to the White Mountains suggested a walking time of 4 hours and 15 minutes, so we were pretty proud. There may be more demanding and exciting summits to reach along the Appalachian Trail than Mount Washington, but none can be more startling. You labor up the last steep stretch of rocky slope to what is, after all, a considerable eminence, and pop your head over the edge, and there you are greeted by, of all things, a vast terraced car park, full of automobiles, gleaming hotly in the sun. Beyond stands a scattered complex of buildings, among which move crowds of people in shorts and baseball caps. It has the air of a world fair, bizarrely transferred to a mountaintop. You get so used along the AT to sharing summits with only a few other people, all of whom have worked as hard as you to get there, that this was positively dazzling. On Washington, visitors can arrive by car, on a winding toll road, or on a cog railway from the other side. And hundreds of people, hundreds and hundreds of them, it seemed, had availed themselves of these options. They were everywhere, basking in the sunshine, draped over the railings on the viewing terraces, wandering between various shops and food places. I felt for some minutes like a visitor from another planet. I loved it. It was a nightmare, of course, and a desecration of the highest mountain in the northeast, but I was delighted it existed in one place. It made the rest of the trail seem perfect. The epicenter of activity was a monstrously ugly concrete building, the Summit Information Center, with big windows, broad viewing platforms, and an exceedingly lively cafeteria. Just inside the door was a large list of all the people who had died on the mountain, and the causes, beginning with one Frederick Strickland, a Bridlington, Yorkshire, who lost his way while hiking in an October storm in 1849, and ran on through a quite breathtaking array of mishaps before concluding with the deaths of two hikers in an avalanche just 3 months earlier. Already, six people had died on Washington slopes in 1996, with the year barely half over. Quite a sobering statistic, and there was plenty of room on the board for more. In the basement was a small museum with displays on Washington's climate, geology, and distinctive plant life. But what particularly captivated me was a comical short video called Breakfast of Champions, which I presume the meteorologists had made for their own amusement. It was filmed with a fixed camera on one of the summit terraces and showed a man sitting at a table, as if at an open-air restaurant, during one of its famous blows. While the man holds down the table with his arms, a waiter approaches against the wind with great and obvious difficulty, like someone wing-walking at 30,000 feet. He tries to pour the customer a bowl of cereal, and it all flies horizontally from the box. Then he adds milk, but this goes the same way, mostly over the customer, a particularly gratifying moment. Then the bowl flies away, and the cutlery, as I recall. And then the table starts to go, and then the film ends. It was so good, I watched it twice. Then went off to find Bill so he could see it. But I couldn't spot him in the restless throng, so I went outside onto the viewing platform and watched the cog railway train chuffing up the mountain, pouring out clouds of black smoke as it came. It stopped at the summit station, and hundreds more happy tourists tumbled off. Tourism goes back a long way on Mount Washington. As early as 1852, there was a restaurant at the summit, and the proprietors were serving about 100 meals a day. In 1853, a small stone hotel called Tip Top House was built atop the mountain and was a huge and immediate success. Then in 1869, a local entrepreneur named Sylvester March built the Cog Railway, the first in the world. Everyone thought he was mad, and that even if he succeeded in building the railway, which was doubtful, there wouldn't be any demand for it. In fact, as the disgorging throngs below me demonstrated now, people haven't tired of it yet. 5 years after the railway opened, the old Tip Top was succeeded by a much grander Summit House Hotel, and that was followed by a 40-foot tower with a multicolored searchlight, which could be seen all over New England and far out to sea. By late in the century, a daily newspaper was being published on the summit as a summer novelty, and American Express had opened a branch office. Meanwhile, back at ground level, things were also booming. The modern tourist industry, in the sense of people traveling en masse to a congenial spot and finding lots of diversions awaiting them when they got there, is essentially a White Mountains invention. Massive hotels with up to 250 rooms sprang up in every glen. Built in a jaunty, domestic style, like cottages blown up to the scale of hospitals or sanatoria, these were exceedingly ornate and elaborate structures, among the largest and most complicated ever built of wood, with wandering roof lines robustly punctuated with towers and turrets and every other mark of architectural busyness the Victorian mind could devise. They had winter gardens and salons, dining rooms that could seat 200, and verandas like the promenade decks of ocean liners, from which guests could drink in the wholesome air and survey nature's craggy splendor. The finer hotels were very fine indeed. The Profile House at Franconia Notch had its own private railway line to Bethlehem Junction, 8 miles away. Its grounds held 21 cottages, each with up to 12 bedrooms. the Maplewood had its own casino. Guests at the Crawford House could choose among 9 daily newspapers from New York or Boston, shipped in specially. Whatever was new and exciting, lifts, gas lighting, swimming pools, golf courses, the White Mountain hotels were in the vanguard. By the 1890s, there were 200 hotels scattered through the White Mountains. There has never been a collection of hotels of comparable grandeur anywhere, certainly not in a mountain setting, and now they are virtually all gone. In 1902, the grandest of them all, the Mount Washington Hotel, opened at Bretton Woods in an open, meadowy setting against the backdrop of the Presidential Range. Built in a commanding style described optimistically by the architect as Spanish Renaissance, it was the pinnacle of grace and opulence. With 2,600 acres of cultivated grounds, 235 guest rooms, and every detail of finery that heaps of money could buy. For the plaster work alone, the developers brought in 250 Italian artisans. But already, it was something of an anachronism. Fashion was moving on. American holidaymakers were discovering the seaside. The White Mountain hotels were a little too dull, a little too remote and expensive for modern tastes. Worse, they had begun to attract the wrong sort of people, parvenus from Boston and New York. Finally, and above all, there was the automobile. The hotels were built on the assumption that visitors would come for a fortnight at least, but the motor car gave tourists a fickle mobility. In the 1924 edition of New England Highways and Byways from a Motor Car, the author gushed about the unrivaled splendor of the White Mountains, the tumbling cataracts of Franconia, the alabaster might of Washington, the secret charm of the little towns like Lincoln and Bethlehem, and encouraged visitors to give the mountains a full day and night. America was entering the age not just of the automobile, but of the retarded attention span. One by one, the hotels closed down, became derelict, or, more often, burned to the ground. Often, miraculously, almost the only thing to survive was the insurance policy, and their grounds slowly returned to forest. Once I could have seen perhaps 20 large hotels from the summit. Today there is just one, the Mount Washington, still imposing and festive with its perky red roof, but inescapably forlorn in its solitary grandeur. And even it has staggered along the edge of bankruptcy several times. Elsewhere across the spacious valley far below, where once had proudly stood the Fabian, the Mount Pleasant, the Crawford House, and many others, today there was only forest, highways, and motels. From beginning to end, the great age of the resort hotels in the White Mountains lasted just 50 years. Once again, I offer you the Appalachian Trail as a symbol of venerability, and with that in mind, I went off to find my friend Bill and complete our walk. End of Side 7.